People often wish for other things, for a situation other than the one that they are in. When you're young, you wish you could be older because you see older siblings getting to do things that you can't do. And when you're older, you begin to think, oh, I wish I were younger. I had a lot more energy back then. Of course, I would like to have the knowledge that I have now that I didn't have back then. Or we may think, you know, I wish I didn't live right here, right now, when the ground is covered with snow and I have to shovel the snow off the sidewalk. I wish I were somewhere else where it's nice and warm. And so it is that day after day we come into these situations where we say, I wish that it were that my situation were different. You know that old saying, the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. And one time I saw a cartoon where there was a cow who had stuck her head through the fence and had eaten some grass there and then realized that there was some nice green grass around the other side of the post and back through the fence again, and so it stuck her head right back to where she was, but went all the way through the fence twice and around a post in order to get to it. And that's the way we are sometimes when we try to think of something that would be better for us than what we have found. But you are in this time and place by God's appointment. You are in this time and place by God's appointment. And to wish for something different is not submitting to the sovereign grace and working of God in your life. Now, there may be things that you could do in order to have things differently. You know, the person that says, oh, I wish I were thinner, but I don't want to go on a diet. I don't want to exercise. I don't want to do anything because that's hard work. We get into situations where we wish that things were different, and yet we're not really submitting to the providence of God as to where we are. Maybe it's because we haven't done the things that we ought to have done. But when God puts us in a particular situation, that's where we are to be. The people of God had sinned against him, and because of that, they were taken into exile. And they had been in exile for quite some time. And there was this young lady who was taken to be, although she was one of God's people, she was taken by the court to be the queen. It doesn't appear to be anything that she had sought, but it was where God sovereignly placed her. And then there was a decree that went out that all of God's people, the Jews, were to be destroyed. And she was a Jew. What was she to do? Turn with me, please, to Esther chapter 4. As we read about this young lady and how her cousin directed her, instructed her in the providence of God. Esther, the 4th chapter. When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, referring, of course, to the decree that had been made by Haman and the king's seal was put on it, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly, but he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. In every province in which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent clothes for him to put on instead of his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther summoned Hatak, one of the king's eunuchs assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out why or what was troubling Mordecai and why. So Hatak went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay to the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show to Esther and explain it to her. And he told him to urge her to go into the king's presence to beg for mercy and plead with him for her people. Hatak went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, "All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that he be put to death. The only exception to this is for the king to extend the gold scepter to him and spare his life. But 30 days have been passed since I was called to go to the king." When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer: "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this." Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai: "Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa, and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instructions. May God bless to us the reading of this portion of his holy word. Teach us from it as we consider it before him this morning. The situation was rather dire here. The terminology that was used was very strong, as Haman wanted to get rid of the Jews. Not just, it started out with Mordecai, but he said, "I'm not satisfied with just getting rid of this one man, because there are probably others who think the same way that he does, and he doesn't bow down and honor me the way I think he should do because of his God. So let's get rid of all of them." And he was willing to pay a huge sum to the king's treasury in order that this be happen. And so we come to this chapter that we have just read, and the back and forth between Mordecai and his cousin Esther, and how they resolve the issue and what they're to do. It is the 14th verse that we are considering particularly today. "For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish, and who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this." Think about that first claim that he makes. Relief and deliverance will arise from for the Jews will arise from another place. How could he be so assured that this is what would happen? Well, it's because he knows that God will deliver his people. He knows the promise that God has given to his people, and he knows that God's promises are true, that he always carries out what he has said he would do. Mordecai was well aware of the promise that was made, for example, to Abraham. In you, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Well, how's that going to happen if you and your descendants, Abraham, are wiped out? In you, all the nations would be blessed. Mordecai understood that. And so he says to Esther, if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will come from another place. He knew the promise to David that there would be that king that would come from his house that would bring deliverance. And he was still looking forward to that. And if the Jews would be wiped out, then how could that happen? So he says to Esther, if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will come from another place. The exile had not negated the promise. The exile only meant there was a disruption in the way in life in Israel, but that he would accomplish his purpose. He would bring about deliverance for his people in order to fulfill the promise, so that there would come that king, and through that king then the promise to Abraham would be fulfilled, that in him and his descendants all the nations of the earth would be blessed. And Mordecai knew that that had not yet happened. But we know that that promise has been extended to us, so that we are partakers of the promise that God had given to Abraham. When Paul wrote his letter to the churches of Galatia, he says this at the end of chapter 3, if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's seed, heirs according to the promise. You receive what the promise that God has extended to his people. Now Mordecai couldn't go ahead and look down all of history in order to see exactly how God would bring this about. But he's aware how God had been preserving his people all along, and certainly he does always provide or preserve a remnant. He preserves his people. He forgives sins by providing a sacrifice. He preserves his great name. Just as we think back to that time of the golden calf and the deliverance that God gave to Moses, as he said to Moses, now why don't you just let me wipe out these people and I'll make of you a great nation. How many of us would have said, oh, that sounds like a nice idea? But Moses had a different concern. He was concerned for the name of God. And so in Exodus 33, beginning with verse 10, passage here. It's 32. Exodus 32. But God said, now leave me alone so that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. Then I will make you into a great nation. But Moses sought the favor of the Lord his God. O Lord, he said, why should your anger burn against your people whom you have brought out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say it was with evil intent that he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to wipe them off the face of the earth? Turn from your fierce anger, relent, and do not bring this disaster on your people. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to whom you swore by your own self, I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and I will give your descendants all this land I promised them, and it will be theirs, their inheritance forever. You see, he bases his request on the name of God, that God should be honored among the nations. And this happened later on as they were there in the wilderness, waiting to go into the promised land. In Numbers chapter 14, the people had rebelled because they were unwilling to go up and to take the land because they were afraid that the people up there were too strong and powerful for them. And so they refused to go, and it's because of that then that they ended up being in the wilderness for 40 years. Well, as again, God says to Moses, how long will these people treat me with contempt? How long will they refuse to believe in me in spite of all the miraculous signs I have performed among them? I will strike them down with a plague and destroy them, but I will make you into a nation greater and stronger than they. And so you see, it's the same kind of thing that happened after the incident of the golden calf. But Moses said to the Lord, then the Egyptians will hear about it. By your power, you brought these people up from among them. And they will tell the inhabitants of this land about it. They have already heard that you, O Lord, are with these people, and that you, O Lord, have been seen face to face, that your cloud stays over them, and so forth. If you put these people to death all at one time, the nations who have heard this report about you will say, the Lord was not able to bring these people into the land he promised them on oath. He slaughtered them in the desert. Is that the concern you have that Moses had for the name of God? That God should receive the glory. He does preserve his great name. And this same promise is true for you who call upon him. If you indeed are trusting in Jesus Christ, those last verses of Romans chapter 8 are an incredibly gracious statement of who God is and what he does for his people. What shall we say then? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also, along with him, graciously give us all things? And I'll skip over a few verses and come to verse 37. No, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future nor any powers, neither height nor depth nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord. Imagine, nothing can separate us from the love of God when we are in Christ. He will deliver his people. But he involves you in that deliverance. Yes, he could do it all on his own. He certainly has all power to do that. But he has appointed you for this time so that you might take part in the deliverance that he gives to his people. He has sovereignly placed you here and now. You students, you are in this year's class. You aren't in last year's class. You aren't in next year's class. You are in this year's class because that's where God placed you. You are with those fellow students that you have in your class. You have the particular professors that you have. And you may wish that you had different fellow students and different professors or different teachers in school. But this is where God placed you. And he placed you here from his own, for his own glory. In fact, it is from all eternity that he placed you here and now. Let that sink in. This isn't just a happenstance that you are here now. You who have jobs, it is by the grace of God that you have those jobs. And why has He placed you in those jobs? That you might serve Him. Did you ever wish that you had different parents? God placed you in the family that you're in. It is by God's appointment that you are where you are. And so consider where you are today in light of the providence of God, in light of His appointment. He has placed us here for His glory. And that's the message that Mordecai was giving to Esther when he said, "It may be that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this." And Esther was saying, "Well, that's not really where I want to be. After all, this could mean my death. Because for me to go to the king, if he doesn't hold out that scepter, there's only one thing that's to happen. I'm to be killed. I'm to be executed. I will do it. But gather God's people together and pray for me. And fast for me. And I and the girls who are my servants, my maidservants, will do the same." We seldom face decisions of the magnitude that Esther was facing. And the long-term implications of some of the decisions that we make may not be as clear to us as what Esther was facing here. Nevertheless, we have to consider where we are by God's appointment. As I've lived in different parts of the country, I know that there are people who live right here who would not be at all happy to live in Kansas. And there are people who live in Kansas who would be scared to live here. But God has appointed us each to our place in order that we might serve Him. And we need to consider what the implications are of serving Him and the place we are. What are some of the things that we need to be involved in? Is there an appointment such as Esther had faced? And so we need to be alert to the time and place in which God has put us. What are the gifts that God has given you? What are the opportunities that He has provided for you? How do those gifts and talents and those opportunities come together by the grace of God in order to serve Him, in order to advance His kingdom, in order to make known that He is God? You see, we are to be faithful even in the details of life, because we don't know what messing up in the details of life, what implications that might have later on. God involves you in the deliverance. God involves you in the advancement of His kingdom, as He involved Esther here. But there's a statement between those two that we've looked at so far, where, first of all, Mordecai says to Esther, "If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will come, for the Jews will arise from another place, and who knows whether you have come to a royal position for such a time as this." In between, though, there's there's that statement of warning. You and your father's family will perish. If you do not do this, you and your father's family will perish. You see, we are not mere puppets in this world. We in Presbyterianism, at least historically, have believed in predestination, that God has appointed all things for His glory, but that it's not fatalism. It's not just making us puppets, saying that whatever you do, nothing will change, that you're just going to continue on that course. But there are decisions that have to be made, and here was one for Esther. Which path is it that you're going to take? And what are the implications of that path? If you've watched the series of movies on Back to the Future, that's something that is emphasized in those movies. A path that is chosen has implications later on. You have a choice in how you respond. Esther had a choice here in how she would respond. And we're grateful for the response that she made. But many have chosen wrongly and have suffered for it. You remember the call of Moses, where Moses was basically saying, "Here am I, send someone else. I do not want to do this." And he had to be persuaded to do what God was appointing him to do. And he reluctantly did it. Jonah said, "I don't like God's appointment, and so I'm going to run the other way." Have you ever thought what must have been like in the fish? Can you imagine being conscious in that fish? Somehow you're able to breathe. Somehow you're able to survive. But there were some pretty harsh consequences for Jonah when he did not obey the appointment of God for him. Jonah rebelled. But God got him to do what he had appointed him to do, didn't he? And he still rebelled. He still didn't like what God was doing. There's that incident with the two sisters, Mary and Martha, that's recorded for us in Luke's gospel account, in Luke chapter 10. "Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work by myself? Tell her to help me." "Martha, Martha," the Lord answered, "you are worried and upset about many things, but only one thing is needed. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken from her." Or there's that incident that is found in 1 Kings, or is it 2 Kings? It's one that's not very well known. So I wouldn't be surprised if there are some of you who have never recognized it. 1 Kings chapter 20 is what I have written down in my notes. I hope that's the correct yes. 1 Kings chapter 20, beginning as we come to verse 35, there was one of the prophets by the word of the Lord, one of the sons of the prophets said to his companion, "Strike me with your weapon." But the man refused. Now, if somebody told you to hit them, to injure them, would you do it? Not likely. But he says, by the word of the Lord, you're to do this. So the prophet, and the man refused. So the prophet said, because you have not obeyed the Lord, as soon as you leave me, a lion will kill you. The consequences were pretty great, and that's exactly what happened. You see, destruction awaits you who reject the calling of Christ. The blessing of God is removed, and the curse is given. If you reject Jesus as Lord, you are opting for eternal destruction. And if you refuse to serve him as your Lord, then why should you expect his blessing? So let me ask you again, are you satisfied with God's providential appointments for you? The Apostle Paul, in giving his testimony before King Agrippa, tells about the conversation he had with the Lord as he was knocked to the ground. And one of the things that God says to him, that Jesus says to him, is, it is hard for you to kick against the goads. Those pointed sticks that would be used to get the animal to move. If you've ever tried to get a mule to move that doesn't want to move, you realize you need something else. I was on one of those that in a donkey basketball game, and mine did not want to move at all. And I didn't have a goad with me. It is hard for you to kick against the goads. But you prosper where you are when you submit to the goads that God brings.